The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Sponsored by Raiden Solicitors. Award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
Hello and welcome to The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. I'm Elisa Carcar, bringing you honest conversations to support and inspire you as we navigate this wild parenting journey together. Today, I'm joined by Verena Dixon, founder of Kindent Nutrition. Verena is a registered nutrition professional specializing in family and children's nutrition, supporting parents through everything from weaning and fussy eating to building healthy, positive relationships with food. Through her work, she helps families take the stress and overwhelm out of mealtimes with realistic, evidence-based advice that feels supportive and achievable for everyday life. Welcome, Verena. Thank you so much for joining us on The Parents Show.
Thank you. I'm very excited to be here today.
We're very excited to have you. So, Verena, can you start by telling us a bit about yourself and what first inspired you to get into nutrition?
Yeah. So I grew up in Munich in Germany, and my grandma, she was actually a dietitian. She never really talked about her work, but what she did do, she cooked really well. And every single meal, whether she cooked for me and my brothers, or whether it was a big family gathering, or whether she just cooked for herself, every single meal was perfectly balanced, which I know now as a nutritionist. She literally had soup always to start with, and then her meal was always a protein with some carbohydrates and vegetables, usually finishing with a fruit compote. So really the perfect eat well plate, which is what the government now recommends, which I know now as a nutritionist. But yeah, back in the days, I just really enjoyed her foods. I don't know how much she actually influenced me to become a nutritionist. My own path into nutrition came a little bit later. In my late teens, I got really into fitness and sports and healthy eating. And again, to be honest, with a nutritionist lens looking back, some of that motivation about body image and healthy eating was probably complicated, but it did get me into a nutrition degree. So that's when I first started learning about nutrition and the actual science of it. And I don't know, I think many people feel like that when they start studying something. The more I learned, the more I realized that I didn't know and how much there is to know about nutrition, because it's such a huge field. So after I finished my studies, I just wanted to dig deeper into the science and know a lot more. So that's when I moved to London. I did my master's here in public health nutrition, and that actually changed everything I knew about nutrition, or at least it changed the perspective completely, because before I learned what happens with certain nutrients when we eat them, how do we process them, what do our bodies need. But the public health lens really looks at, why do we eat? How do we eat? What role does the government play? The advertising, the supermarkets, what's available to us? And also with a public health lens, you look at the idea of how, for example, if you change the fiber intake of a whole population just by up it by 1 or 2%, how that can have massive savings on the NHS and a huge impact on health. So yeah, that just really lit something up in me. It was really exciting to see all the different aspects of nutrition. And I think that's sort of when it clicked for me that if I want to have an impact on health or population health, we have to start young. We have to start with children, because so much of our relationship with food, our habits, our beliefs, all of those are laid down in childhood. So a lot of the habits and a lot of why we eat, how we eat, really starts then. So yeah, that's when I got into child nutrition and started focusing on child nutrition. And then 7 years ago, I set up my own private practice, Kinder Nutrition, where I now support families with all their nutrition-related challenges. So anything food and kids-related, I deal with now, and I'm happy to support families in that.
Amazing. Yeah, it's such a vast field, isn't it? There's lots of things you said there that I really hadn't thought about in relation to nutrition, but you've definitely got my brain ticking over. You've got two children of your own, that's right, isn't it?
Yes, I have a five-year-old and a three-year-old.
Okay. Did you set up the company before or after becoming a mother?
So I set up the company before becoming a mother. I then had my first child sort of 3 years into it.
Okay, amazing. And like, did that change the way you think about food, becoming a mother and seeing it, I guess, from like you would have been supporting families, not as a mother, and then all of a sudden you become a mother and kind of experience it that way. Has that kind of like shifted your perspective or changed any of the sort of advice you give from families from your own sort of motherhood experience?
Yes, 100%. I think when you become a mother, a lot changes. Think how you see things and how you experience things. It has definitely changed things for me. For example, I remember vividly, I think I will never forget that, in the first few days I was breastfeeding my first baby, and I was very lucky that it was going well from the get-go. Actually, we had a beautiful feeding relationship, and I knew to look for the hunger and fullness cues and sort of all the things I always talk about. But he was feeding so much. And yeah, I found myself Googling, can I overfeed a breastfed fat baby? And I knew the answer because I talked about it all the time, but I didn't expect him to feed that much. So yeah, there's definitely my kids still to this day teach me a lot. As I said, they are 3 and 5 now. And yeah, I always talk about children's appetites vary, right? Sometimes they're really hungry. Sometimes they eat hardly anything at all. That is completely normal. If they eat according to their hunger and fullness cues, that's amazing. And yet I still get surprised sometimes when they don't eat hardly anything, or if they have a growth spurt and how much food they can put away, I still get surprised. So it definitely made me realize that even when you know all these things, doing it in practice and seeing it is different. And another big takeaway for me since becoming a mother is that just knowing that it's so hard to fit everything in, and that's everything in your brain, everything you think about, their health, their nutrition, their friendships, their development, their confidence, it's all constantly going on in your mind. So fitting all of that in, but also fitting everything in a day, is preparing the snacks, preparing meals, having meals with the family, ideally, the pickups, the drop-offs, the play dates, it's so much. So experiencing that and knowing that makes it a lot easier for me to relate to the families and to understand that even though families might come with the same challenges to me, there might be completely different solutions for every family depending on their setup and depending on their family lifestyle.
Yeah. And maybe sometimes we just have to let go of the idea that we're going to be able to create that perfect scenario on that day, because there's just too much going on.
100%. And there's so many days, so we don't have to get it right all the time.
That's good. So many days we don't have to get it right all the time. I think that's definitely something good to bear in mind. So what are some of the biggest challenges you see parents face when it comes to feeding their children and creating these healthy habits? And also, like, have you seen that change over the time that you've been working in this field?
I've definitely seen an increase in children with allergies. So I have a lot of children with allergies in my practice. Fussy eating has always been a big topic. Both younger children that naturally go through that stage, but also eating challenges and sort of fussy eating and sensory issues with children with neurodivergence. That has become more of a thing. I see more families. And then, unfortunately, with older kids and also younger kids as well now, I see a lot more disordered eating behaviors fueled by diet culture, by social media. I think that's definitely an area that's rapidly increasing and very worrying.
Yeah, absolutely. You said before, I picked up that you said that the normal phase of fussy eating in young children. Can you dig a bit more into that? I'm interested.
Yeah, so usually when we start weaning our babies onto solid foods, there's a lot of children are very enthusiastic about eating, and often I hear that from families who then come with a fussy eater that their baby used to eat everything and they loved food and they were so happy to explore new foods and tried everything, and then they hit that sort of 2 to 3 year old stage and suddenly they become so fussy and so hard to feed, and parents panic a little bit because suddenly They don't want to eat their vegetables anymore. They don't want pasta sauce on their pasta anymore. They just want the plain pasta. And it seems that you had everything under control and it was going so well. And then suddenly, no, your child is now a fussy eater. But it is actually a very normal stage. It's children become more aware of the food they see. They become more aware of their own autonomy. They want to decide what goes inside their bodies. And they have to have a lot of experiences with different foods at that time. And experiences doesn't mean they have to try everything. They have to see it. They have to see us eat it. They have to smell it. And yeah, it's a good few. It can be a good few years of just being a bit wary of food for young children at that age.
God, I definitely identify that. And even I've got a 14 and a 10 year old and I'm feeling reassured that you've said that this is a normal phase, because I distinctly remember trying so hard with my eldest. I exposed her to all sorts of adventurous foods and she lapped it up, and then she went through that kind of sort of fussy phase. And it was, yeah, you feel like you've done something wrong. You didn't do it the right way. Therefore, your child's got this kind of beige food, love. It tends to be like beige foods, doesn't it?
Very carb heavy beige foods is what they like at that stage.
Pasta and bread. And what would be your sort of general, what advice, if you could give any in this kind of short time we have on this interview, would you give to parents that are right in that phase right now?
Yeah, first of all, don't panic. Now you know it's a phase. The important thing, as you say, is how to react to that. So we don't want to cater just to now giving beige foods or plain foods, but it is important to give the children their autonomy and to express that autonomy. Yeah. So we will still serve the foods we always serve, but we make sure there's a food always on the table that feels safe for them. So whether that's the pasta, the rice, the bread, we usually know by then that they're safe foods. So we always make sure there's a safe food on the table, but otherwise we just continue how we have been doing it up to this date, which is cooking all the vegetables, preparing all the meals that we enjoy eating as parents. And when they see us enjoying those meals and when they get exposed to those foods, as I already said, when they see them, even if they don't touch them, eventually they will get out of that stage. They will become more adventurous again. They will eat those foods again. So yeah, we just have to keep the course for that time.
Yeah. Okay. So keep cooking the healthy foods, keep offering it, but I guess just manage your own expectations that they might not eat it. Cause there's emotion around that, isn't there? Like when you've spent time cooking something and you put all this effort into it and you're really wanting to nourish your child's body and then they don't eat it, that can feel a bit emotional.
Yeah, it can be really hard, but it's really important to know that feeding is a relationship. It's not us doing it to our children. It is a relationship. And in that relationship, we as the parents have our jobs to do and the children have their jobs to do. So our jobs are what goes on the table when we serve those foods and meals and snacks and where we serve them. Those are our jobs, but only those. And then it is the child's job to decide what they want to eat from what's on the table and how much they want to eat. And it is really hard, but we need to trust them, because children actually have amazing bodies and they come with a drive to eat and grow, and they come with a drive to grow according to their genetic blueprint. So they will get from a meal what they need. And quite often when I have parents who say they have a fussy eater, when you actually look at the foods they eat, most of the time they do still meet their nutritional demands. So it's really about taking a step back, completely taking the pressure out of eating. We're not telling them to finish their plates. We're not telling them to eat their vegetables. We're not praising them for trying something new. We just do our job, which is when, where, and what to feed. But then we leave it completely. We can relax. We can enjoy our foods. We can sit back. We can relax. And then we leave it completely up to the kids to decide what to eat from what's on the table and how much. And that is so important, because they then learn to eat according to their hunger and fullness cues. And they learn to trust their own bodies. And that to children feels really empowering. If they don't eat broccoli for 2 years, nothing is lost. But if therefore they have a good relationship with food long term, it will help them so much more.
Yeah, so it's you're on the long game, really, rather than worrying about this particular plate of food. And so you wouldn't, I presume, advise that a child can't leave the table until their plate is empty.
No, absolutely not. I mean, it's, I think, how we grew up a lot of the times. And it sits deep in our beliefs. And even when we hear it, it feels normal to us that we should finish the plate. But unfortunately, that way we learn to ignore our hunger and fullness cues. And yeah, that is a real shame. If we can manage for our children to listen to their hunger and fullness cues, it's amazing to see. Sometimes you see a child wants a cookie, but they have one bite and leave the rest, which for adults can be really, really difficult. So we really want to instill that habit of them just trusting their body and eating what they need and how much they need. And any pressure from us backfires.
Yeah.
They will push against that. If we try to push the vegetables, if we try to make them finish their plates, it creates tension, it creates friction, and they may want to do the opposite.
Yeah. You must get parents all the time saying, if I let them eat as much or little as possible or choose their foods, they wouldn't make good choices.
So you're still in control of what goes on the table. So it's still within what you have provided. So you can certainly guide that a little bit. But yes, from within what you have provided, you should definitely let them make their own choices. And if they don't eat the vegetables, even, as I said, even for a longer period of time, most of the time they will get those nutrients from either from fruits or from somewhere else. But it's that habit that you instill.
Yeah, yeah. So you're only providing really choices that you're happy with. And if there are some kind of, I guess, sweet treats on there, it's only the amount that you would be happy for them to eat. So it's just giving them a choice that you're happy with, really.
Yeah, so sweets come in a little bit differently. So for any food other than sweets that you have on the table, I would provide as much as you have. I mean, if they want more pasta and you have more pasta, then they can have more pasta. Sweets is slightly different. So, I mean, that's a whole... We can talk about this for an hour, right? Sugar and sweets. But usually for mealtimes, I would provide only a child-sized portion of sweets for the child, because it can interfere with their hunger cues, because they taste very sweet, they are very likable, and they could overeat on that. But it is important, and this can be a little bit scary, and I've done this experiment with so many families, and they all found it a little bit scary in the beginning. With snacks, we have a chance to sometimes provide an abundance of cookies, sweets, chocolate. Do that and let the children experience their switch off for that particular food. So the sugary foods they're not on a pedestal. They're not something special they never get. Every now and then, let them have as much as they want, even if they ask for more. I wouldn't recommend that for dinner time or meal times, because there's other foods they should eat. But for snack times, every now and then, if you provide chocolates, cookies, sweets, to make them less special, to make them less available just on fun occasions like the birthday parties or the special occasions.
Okay, good. Yeah, that does sound a bit scary. Mm-hmm. Would you, with the dessert, for example, in a meal, this would be a very normal thing happening in, you know, houses up and down the country, giving the dessert after the main meal and only if they've finished the meal or what you judge to be a correct amount of that main meal? I think I've read things about serving it at the same time. Is there a particular order that you would serve these foods?
The problem with serving it only when you have finished your plate is that we are firstly putting that dessert on a pedestal again. It's a reward. It's something that I get for doing something. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't recommend that. And it also, again, encourages the children. They have to finish their plate, so they're not listening to the hunger and fullness cues. If you are serving dessert, serving it at the same time as the meal is absolutely fine, because then they have their child-sized portion and usually move on to the meal afterwards. And it can take that pressure away for everyone, because some children, if they're so hooked up on their dessert, then they might just eat quickly just to get to the dessert. So it's definitely a good idea to serve it alongside the meal. But I do look, it depends on the family and the setup and how the children behave around desserts. Like, for example, in our family, we don't have desserts that often. It's not something the children expect. If I cook something very adventurous that I really fancied and this they really didn't like, then I serve a yogurt afterwards to make sure that they are actually full enough. But I think if you don't have that expectation of a dessert, it takes a lot of pressure away from everyone.
It's quite a British thing, isn't it? Having a dessert after every meal. Like, I remember when I first sent my children to school here in the UK, and there's a dessert after lunch. I was like, we don't even have desserts at home. How are you getting a dessert? So they were like really excited to have school lunches because they always get a dessert.
Yeah. Yeah, same here. My son is very excited about the desserts. And I mean, we still eat sweet foods for snack times quite often, but dessert for dinner, I just haven't made it a habit. So they don't expect it, which makes things a lot easier.
Gosh, yeah, there's so much to this. And there is a lot of conflicting advice online, I think. Social media doesn't help, does it? You can kind of go down a lot of rabbit warrens. But like, from your point of view, for a parent listening who's kind of, wow, this is quite interesting, what could I do today? Is there kind of like one or two simple things that you could recommend that all parents could do today that, you know, start doing today that could help?
Yeah, so I mean, the one thing that I would tell parents to do is keep to your jobs at feeding. Really try to take the pressure out. Really try to allow your child this autonomy of choosing their own foods from what you have offered. And then within that variety, just offer plenty of variety. And that can look different from family to family, especially from child to child, especially if you have a child that is a fussy eater or in a fussy stage. They might not accept a huge amount of variety, but within their safe foods, see if you can increase variety. For example, if they love pasta, how far can you go? Can you have different shapes of pasta? Can you include whole grains? I mean, if you look at the pasta as in the supermarkets nowadays, there are pea pastas and lentil pastas. So just try to increase the variety both within the foods that are their safe foods and with new foods. Keep offering new foods. Keep offering the foods you enjoy eating. That is so important to me because, and it's the second thing I would recommend. I mean, we know we are their role models. How we eat, how we feed ourselves is how they will feed themselves. That this is their basis, what they're learning at home. So make sure you enjoy your foods. Look at your own relationship with your food. Look at your relationship with your own body. And instead of trying to make your child eat their vegetables, actually think about, am I enjoying this? What is my relationship to food? What is my, what foods do I enjoy? And yeah, just really model that enjoyment for food and positivity around food.
Amazing. It's so thought-provoking. I need to go away and have a little think about, you know, the foods that I have in my house and that I'm offering my children. And these words that you've used, like safe foods, as just not a concept I've ever heard of, but it makes perfect sense. It's, you know, they feel emotionally safe with it.
Yeah, especially for very young children, as long as they have something on the table that they can fill up on and they can eat enough of to not be hungry. So yeah, typically, as I already said, things like pasta, but also plain yogurt or even a glass of milk. My little one loves milk, so she always drinks milk with her dinner. And if she doesn't fancy the dinner, at least I know she's had a good full glass of milk. That'll see her through the night.
Yeah.
Right? So as long as they have something they like and that can fill them up on the table, it takes the pressure away from them to have to eat anything they might not like.
Yeah.
And that does encourage them to try new foods. I just had the situation yesterday with my three-year-old who was just going through that very fussy stage. And I served her pasta with sauce, my mistake, because she shouted at me for having sauce on it. So I gave her plain pasta and she ate it. She was very hungry. She ate actually the whole portion and then asked for pasta with sauce afterwards. So just taking that pressure away first. Maybe she was too hungry to cope with the sauce at that point, or it just wasn't what she expected. But within the same meal, she ate the pasta and she ate pasta with sauce. So,
yeah. We need to stop vilifying pasta, I suppose. It's not the bad guy.
No.
It can be really important.
Children are growing, and what they need to grow is carbs. They need a lot of carbs. They need it for their brain. They need it for running around. They need it for growing. Yes, they need protein. Yes, they need ideally healthy fats, but they need a lot of carbs. And compared to adults, they need a lot more carbs to protein and fat ratio. That's why for us, sometimes it feels like all they eat is carbs, but they need it. And their body is taking it because they need it. They need it to grow.
Well, I feel like I could go on for another half an hour, but we do need to finish our interview now. That's been so thought-provoking. I've learnt loads. I'm sure our listeners have learnt loads. Thank you so much for joining us. If the listeners would like to find out more about your work or get in touch with you, how could they reach you?
Yeah, so you can find me on Instagram at kindernutrition, or my website is kindernutrition.co.uk, and you can find my email on there and just send me a DM, send me an email, get in touch. I'm happy to help.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Verena.
Thank you. It was lovely to be here.
If you've just joined us, that was Verena Dixon from Kinder Nutrition, sharing her expertise on children's nutrition, family mealtimes, and some simple, realistic ways parents can support healthy eating habits at home. You've been listening to The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. I'm Elisa Carcar, and I'll be back next time with more honest conversations to support and inspire you on your parenting journey.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6, sponsored by Raiden Solicitors, award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
So welcome to The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. I'm Lydia El-Khoury, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Jeanette Kennedy, who is a chartered financial planner at DGS Independent Financial Advisors. So, Jeanette, thanks a million for joining us on The Parents Show today.
No problem. Nice to be here. Thank you.
I can ask you all those stupid questions that I've never understood anything to do with finance or financial planning. So it's brilliant to get to pick your brains on the show.
Excellent. Well, I think you're not alone in that. So yeah, ask away.
Great stuff. Okie doke. So today we're going to focus on child benefits. And if we've time, we'll move on to childcare and early years funding. So, right, let's start off with child benefits. Jeanette, tell us what's available out there. Tell us how the system works at the moment for a start.
Well, I think the most important thing to understand is you need to claim it. If you don't claim it, nobody comes knocking on your door. And I think it's really easy, as we all know, when you've got a young baby, filling in paperwork or going online could be the last thing you want to do. But if you don't claim it, you won't get it. But that's not an irretrievable situation, but it is worth having. But there are a few things that I think we need to sort of add into that in itself. But I'll explain. For your eldest or your first child, you get £27.05. And for each additional child, and there's no upper limit on the payments, it's £17.90, and that's paid every 4 weeks, and that's paid until the child turns 16, or if you begin to earn over the limits. So that's the big caveat, and this is why lots of people don't claim it, because they think, oh, I'm not entitled to it, my household is, you know, fortunate enough to have a high income, there's no point. But the problem with that is that if you don't claim it, it links into other things such as credit for your state pension. So you get national insurance credits if you make this claim that you may not get if you're having a period out of work. So you wouldn't be getting national insurance because you're working and paying that. You need to get this credit against your national insurance record, because that effectively buys your state pension. So there's a lot of things in that.
There is. And that's a total eye opener. I had no idea. And I bet there's loads of parents listening in going, damn it. So you did say a lovely word, not irretrievable. So that, I'm going to come back to that when you're ready.
Yes.
But so it links to your pension. I did not know that. Tell
it
us does. More.
Well, the thing about it is that it when you claim until your child turns 12, you can get NASH insurance credits because you're basically you're a primary carer. And so if you're not working or you have a period out of work, instead of having to think, oh, now I need to go back in and do this or I need to make some other arrangements. And I have encountered people who've even bought their national insurance credits because they had these gaps, when actually you could have had that from your claiming child benefit. So always claim. But whether then you want to have the money come in, well, that then is when we start looking at, okay, well, what is that household income or your individual income to the people within the household? So it will be triggered on whoever is in the household. It's not a combined income. But once somebody begins to earn over £60,000 a year, then there is a calculation that needs to be undertaken. So, of course, it's not just straightforward, but that transition of every 1%, which is £200, every £200 that you go over £60,000, you lose 1% of your child benefit. So that £200 spread over £60,000 all the way up to £80,000 is 100% of the child benefit, and you would lose it. So lots of people, as I say, when they think, well, I or my husband or my partner, civil partner, whatever, earns over £80,000, they don't bother to claim. But the thing is, you can make a claim and then reject having the payment. So you can actually say, well, but I don't want the money. So you don't need to take that payment.
That's brilliant advice. It makes complete sense that you would do that.
That, of course, leaves lots of people that land within that tax trap, effectively, yeah. Isn't it? Because it means that you're paying a tax on the loss of your child benefit. Now, you can adjust your pay. So there are steps that you can take to adjust your pay. And it is actually quite a good way of boosting your pension. Because if you make a payment into your pension, and that includes those standard auto-enrollment payments that we're now making, everybody gets to the opportunity to make those into their pension, that counts towards this adjusted net income calculation. So I can see why lots of people go, oh my gosh, run this past me again, because you think, right, okay, so I earn 62,000, let's say, but you happen to pay £2,000 into your pension. Well, your adjusted net income would go down to £60,000. So you would have full entitlement to your child benefit. And so sometimes, even if it may be a little bit more than you had perhaps wished to pay into your pension, it makes real sense to actually make that additional payment so that you bring that adjusted net income down to within that limit, and you can regain that 1% or 2% or however many percent of the child benefit. And with multiple children, of course, that figure gets bigger. So it's like a larger family tax.
Got it. I got it. Okay. That's brilliant. That's really enlightening, Jeanette. Thanks so much for explaining that. Any other things that maybe we should be aware of in relation to child benefit?
Well, I don't know about you, but I also often get approached for, you know, just giving contributions, sponsorships and all of this. And we merrily tick off gift aid, usually, if we're earning a salary. And then I'm not sure everybody is so good at actually adding them to their tax returns or making HMRC aware of them. Well, they also count with this adjusted net income payment. So if you're giving money to charity, the gross amount, including that gift aid, also can come off. So if you're scrabbling around and you've been generous to charities and your friends over the year, make sure you keep a record of those payments, because not only do they impact your tax, but they also impact things like these adjusted net income calculations. So that's something to be aware of as well.
It certainly is. I had no idea about that either. Oh, that's really, really good to know, because I think a lot of us, we do, like, you get a lot of things coming in from school and friends and family asking you to chip in 20 quid or 30 quid here and there. So it's fantastic to know that. Thank you.
Well, and another point just on that child benefit claim, I don't know if your children are old enough to have had their national insurance number miraculously appear through the post. That is actually connected to a child benefit claim. Believe it or not, that triggers the issuance of your child's national insurance number when they're 16. And if you never claim, they then need to apply for a national insurance number, which, again, you know, is not exactly something that is the first thing on your mind on your 16th birthday. But it's just another piece of housekeeping that would fall to you if you haven't made that child benefit claim. So that's just a secondary thing that we are aware of as well.
Really good to know. I had no idea. And that piece of paper came through the door about a year ago. And so really, really great to know.
We said about the payment that if you haven't claimed child benefit, how you can repair that situation. So should I perhaps explain a bit about that?
Yes, please, Jeanette.
Yeah. So this has been a common problem. And the government have recognised that really it's often women that are impacted by this. So there is going to be a scheme. It was supposed to have come in this year, but there is going to be a scheme where you can claim those missing years. And there will be a form that can be filled in. You can make that application, and the missing gaps in your national insurance record actually will be able to be retrospectively repaired. So it's coming. It was supposed to be this year, but we think now they've said it's been pushed back to April 2027. So if anybody is looking at gaps in their national insurance record, if you've ever been into the portal on the Government Gateway site, and you can click on your national insurance record, and if you see that there are gaps, there is the opportunity to pay for those national insurance gaps. But I would, if you know that you had a child that was under 12 that you were caring for, and that's why you've got those gaps in your national insurance record, I wouldn't be rushing to pay them just yet. I would keep a note of the fact that come April 2027, we can go back in, we believe this is coming, and it should be launched at that point, and you can repair your record in that way. So that will save you the money.
That's brilliant. I wonder, I kind of feel like it's all sounding very familiar. And I think it's sounding like conversations I've had, not with the information that you're providing, but with the questions that you're answering through chats with friends. And as you say, mostly women, because more often than not, the primary caregiver is women. I mean, I know that's changing as the generations grow, but that's great to know. Thanks, Jeanette.
No problem.
So we've learned so much about child benefits and how important they are. That link to pensions is an eye opener, and even linking it then to our children, our 16-year-olds, national insurance. That's a bit of a mind blower for me. But let's move on to childcare and early years funding, if that's okay.
Yes, of course.
So tell us about how the system is constructed at the moment, and any flags you want to wave at us.
Well, I mean, I will say this is really complex, because It's a bit of a bolt-on scheme that has evolved over a number of years, and there's different points of provision for different age groups. And that has also been changed from the 15 to the 30 hours. There are caveats as to whether you are working or a working parent, and then the number of hours that you achieve during that work. So there is what we call the working parents entitlement. And that's basically, if you're, as it says in the description, if you're working and you are doing 16 hours or more at the minimum wage each, so that's each of the adult workers in the household, or if you're just alone, then that would interact with other allowances, but that buys you entitlement to care at 30 hours per week for 38 weeks. And it is for the, I know, the term after the child turns 9 months.
9 months, right.
Now, once you have an older child and you get into the school system, all of these term dates and the number of weeks and the provision, it becomes sort of almost familiar territory. And it's almost like that provision is spreading down towards the younger children. And so for 9 months, it's either the term after they turn 9 months, so the 1st of January, the 1st of April, or the 1st of September. So you can see the school terms effectively, that then they become eligible for that. And that then is applied for and then granted via your provider. Not all providers will actually be in the scheme. So you have to check with the chosen provider, but then they will apply for you via the local authority. This interacts with a further allowance, which is like a tax free subsidy. So you've got some tax-free childcare, which is all, this is done via a portal, and you basically have up to £2,000 of tax-free subsidy. And that then is layered up. That's where you can lose that childcare subsidy if you breach the £100,000 earnings limit. Now, in the same manner that the child benefit can be adjusted with that adjusted net pay calculation, the same thing applies at this £100,000 limit. But it's a nastier way of applying it, because we would term it cliff edge. You're either a pound over and you lose it, or you're still in it. So you need to be really careful on that you don't stray over. But because it's an automatic loss and it interacts with other areas of our taxation system, breaching that £100,000 limit, I know it seems an awful lot of money, and
yeah,
anybody would be very pleased with that. But it's a very expensive thing to do if you have young children, because you can lose that tax-free childcare allowance. So we have a spreadsheet in our office, because it is so complicated to work out. And it was drawn up by one of my colleagues who has two young children.
Yeah.
To work out how many hours they do, what the subsidy is, when it kicks in, what it applies, what the child-free element is, because it isn't straightforward. But the first port of call, really, I think, is your care provider. Is, are they in the schemes or not? And then you can begin to initiate, am I eligible? Am I earning under 100,000? Okay, right, I've got this multi-layered provision for those younger years.
Brilliant. Oh, thanks so much, Jeanette. I mean, it'll be ringing bells, and it is definitely a lot to absorb. But if any of our listeners are listening live, there'll be a podcast, and you'll be able to kind of scribble notes and listen to it again, because you're clearly an expert on this and you know your stuff.
I think the thing is, there is a universal entitlement that then kicks in when people aren't working, and this adds another layer of complexity when a child in that 3 to 4 gap, which is often that preschool area, that's a different thing again. And then your company may have a nursery subsidy that allows some salary sacrifice. So you can see this is a really, really complex area to navigate. And I do think that one of the government websites that I like is that Best Start in Life. It's the UK government and it has really good frequently asked questions. It doesn't have a spreadsheet for the calculations, but it does actually have good explanations of all of this. And I think it's the sort of thing that if I were listening to myself back, I'm sure I would think, oh my goodness, what? So it's worth a read. And then you can go back and read again, or possibly at some point we'll have a question and answer session or something that may help.
Brilliant. Thanks. Thanks so much, Jeanette. So child benefits, think of wrapping my head around it. Childcare and early years funding, very complex, but it sounds like the resources are there online to support you.
Yes. Yes.
Great stuff. Thanks so much, Jeanette. Any last tip before we wrap up today? Any last tips for our listeners on those two topics?
No, we said it's mainly women, but of course, if there is, you know, in families now, you and I will have seen dads at the school gate, which is great. If people are taking turns with being a stay-at-home parent, you can swap these allowances for National Insurance between the people that are claiming the benefit and those that need the credits. All of these things are possible. But the first point is, make sure it's claimed. And then if there are any glitches, there is usually a way of sorting that out.
That's very reassuring, because I think that's a lot of the insecurity around this is just thinking that if you don't do it, it's too late. So there's no point and you might as well just keep plowing ahead. So there is a way back and a way to undo it. And I mean, from my own experience, occasionally when I've had to ring HMRC, they're extremely helpful and nice when you get through.
They are. And I think that was going to be the point, that if you are in any of these tapers with child benefit, it's better to claim it and then do a tax return to ensure that you're not, you know, you're not going to come unstuck at any point. But they're very helpful if you do phone them. And I always say, if you don't get somebody helpful, you have to ring back. Yeah. It's like, have a second attempt.
Have a second attempt. Yeah, my experience has always been really, really positive. That's brilliant, Jeanette. Thanks so much. We're going to beg you to come back and give us more advice in a few weeks, if that's okay. And thanks so much for your advice, your knowledge, and for sharing it so generously.
Oh, no problem at all. Lovely to speak to you.
So that was Jeanette Kennedy, Chartered Financial Planner at DGS Independent Financial Advisors. Thanks a million, Jeanette.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6, sponsored by Raiden Solicitors, award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.